Transition Radio from San Diego, exploring the world of change with you. Are you ready to take your life to a new level? Join transition coaches and best-selling authors Paula Shaw and Kendi Foster as they explore strategies to navigate changes in health, relationships, money, career, and so much more. Get the information and tools to make your life smoother, easier, and more productive. And now, your hosts, Paula Shaw and Kendi Foster.
And welcome to Transition Radio. It's D-Day, and we have a lot to talk about today. We have some amazing guests with us. My dad, Jack Gutman, who is one of the last living remaining veterans of the invasion of Normandy, which happened 73 years ago today. And also another amazing man who has overcome incredible adversity when his son was murdered in a senseless way. And out of that, he has created something incredibly beautiful to try to help other families avoid ever having that experience. Azeem Kamisa will be with us a little bit later.
Yeah, this show is all about courage, fortitude, sweat, blood, forgiveness, renewal. So if you've gone through transitions in your life where you have had challenges, maybe you've had people come back from the war. Maybe you've had people that are currently in military fighting wars out there for us. Maybe you're a person that is going through some real challenges in your life. If you are, this is the show to listen to, because we have some not only great stories, we have some solutions to some of the challenges that come out of war, that come out of going through the battle. Yeah. So I'm excited about this.
Yeah. Me too.
Great to have your dad on the show.
I
wow,
know.
Can you believe
it's
that?
It's exciting. This is actually a return appearance for him. He was here last year around this time. So welcome, Dad. So glad you're here.
Thank you for inviting me back.
Of course.
Well,
so let
right
me tell our listeners a little bit about Dad. He was born in San Francisco in 1925. He grew up in a tough neighborhood, actually, in New York City, where survival meant being part of a gang. At 17 years of age, when World War II was about to break out, like so many young men, he wanted to serve his country. So he actually convinced his father to sign for him because he was too young to go. And off he went. He enlisted in the Navy. And his first gig, so to speak, was preparing a hospital in England that they were going to be bringing the survivors of some major attack back to. You didn't even know what the attack was, did you, Dad?
No, we had no idea.
And it was what we now call D-Day, which, by the way, D-Day is the military term for any kind of the day that a combat mission is supposed to happen. But, of course, June 6th, D-Day, the invasion of Normandy, is the most famous D-Day ever, right?
Exactly. One of the most brutal ones also.
Yes. Tell us a little bit. Paint the picture for us, Dad. What was it like coming across that channel on June 6, 1944?
Okay. Thank you for inviting me here. Look back and think about anyone you know, 17, 17 and a half, enjoying parties and everything else, and then I want you to know I, at 17 and a half, was on an APA ship going across the channel. That evening, but this was June 5th, the day before Normandy, which we didn't know what it was until we got there. We were having nice meals. The Navy was very good to feed us. I was a Navy medic, and my job was to hit the beaches and patch them up and evacuate them. And we were going to evacuate them back to the hospital we had prepared for 5 months. But we didn't know what it was for. So here we were enjoying ourselves, laughing and enjoying meals. And
I mean, you knew something big was coming the next day, but you guys actually didn't know what. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, we were apprehensive. And of course, we've done practice invasions and we thought it was going to be kind of a cakewalk. Mm-hmm. And then the next morning, early, about 5, when we arrived at Normandy, and we were out many miles from what the beaches are.
And you said the seas were quite choppy, right?
Seas were very, very choppy. And we start hearing the cannons from the various ships. I want you to picture this. There were 5,000 ships, 4,500 landing craft, 11,000 airplanes of various types, and 150,000 men, English, Canadian, and American, were going to hit those beaches.
So in a way, it's sort of like it was set up to be a victory, an easy victory, but it didn't turn out that way. Why?
Well, we started off, when we climbed down the nets, all of a sudden the waters were very choppy. And unfortunately, the guys ate too much the night before, and they were seasick. A lot of them were seasick. And they loaded about 20 to 30 men into that boat.
A landing craft.
You climb down the nets, and you go in the boat, and you have to catch it when it's going high. Lots of casualties there because they either fell and injured themselves into the boat. When we bivouacked around, it goes in like first wave, second wave, third wave, and the bombarding is going on already. And then when you look at it as you got closer, when you came in, I came in around the 14th wave, which is the first, second, and third waves are the attack forces.
Mm-hmm. They're on the beach.
And we, like I said, thought it was going to be a cakewalk, but it was like an absolute nightmare. Now, one of the big problems that happened, the shelling on the beach, when we looked at it, we said nothing could be alive there. But there were bunkers up there where the Germans were. All they were made of concrete and steel.
And they had big guns in those bunkers,
big
right?
Big guns, and they had a couple of machine guns that shot off 150 bullets a minute.
Ooh.
And we thought, with all the shelling and everything, and then the planes started going over. Now, the plan was with tanks coming in, which no tanks hit because they were on flotation devices. The water was so bad, the tanks flipped over, and they, because of the barriers by the beach, that was an absolute nightmare.
Were those German barriers?
The German barriers. Yeah. They had these steel girders and everything, concrete and so forth.
So you couldn't just roll equipment.
Normally, when you come in on the invasions, you come right up to the beach, the tank or the ramp comes down, and you run off the beach. Could not do this. We had to be out in the water because the girders were blocking us. So we had to wade in water up to our necks.
In heavy packs, right? You had heavy packs?
Heavy packs. Now, what had happened as we were coming in, we see the bombarding. The airplanes had gone over, which we didn't know. I didn't find this out until way later, that they were supposed to drop it on those bunkers and just demolish them, which they would have. They actually dropped, which I found out reading about this, because at the time I didn't know the amount, 34,000 bombs were dropped, but they dropped 3 miles on the other side of the bunkers because they could not see the beach due to cloud cover.
So the airplanes could not see the bunkers they were trying to drop the bombs on, so they dropped them 3 miles inland?
Yeah, they were told to watch the edge of the water if you could see it, count three, and then drop the bombs. And when they did, and with the planes going, it was 3 miles, so all of that was lost. So the forces coming in were just annihilated as they came off the ramps.
By those big guns.
Yeah, by the big guns and the machine guns. And what, unfortunately, guys panicked, and they were so seasick, and some of them really didn't care what was going on. Now, they had these heavy packs which were 50 to 100 pounds, or maybe more, because they carried hand grenades and everything else. They panicked, and they jumped off the side because they saw the people being shot there. And as they jumped off the side, they sunk right down to the bottom with the packs.
Oh, my goodness.
And if they couldn't get the packs off them...
So they drowned before they even hit the beach. Is that what you're saying?
They drowned before they hit the beach. And a lot of those guys that on the the first, second, third waves were just mowed down. Some of them never got a shot off. A lot of those guys had drowned. And of course, there was a lot, which we found out later. We saw bodies in the water as we were coming in. Mm-hmm. But we found out later this was the ships, the LCVPs, the landing craft, had flipped over due to the bad water because they flooded, water kept flooding in, and they were bailing it out. But some flipped over, and the guys were in the water. And
so, Dad, I can't even imagine being 18 years old and not only seeing this horrifying scene, but now you have a job to do. You're supposed to go onto the beach and patch these guys up, the ones they're going to be able to try to transport back
right.
to a hospital, right? What was that like? Can you tell us a little bit?
When I finally got on the beach, coming in, you could see bodies floating. It was just horrible. And that's what put me through my post-traumatic stress for 66 years. Mm-hmm. But my job was to get onto the beach, patch them up, and you could hear the men screaming, Mama, Mama. It was a horrible sight, you know.
I'm sure.
And if you saw Saving Private Ryan, take that picture and double it. That's how bad it was. Mm-hmm. Because Private Ryan didn't show all the body parts we saw.
Mm. And so,
there was 35,000 mines on the beach with barbed wire. And since the tanks and a lot of the demolition crew could not get rid of all of them, when the guys ran onto the beach there, they hit these mines and they were blown up. So this was another horrible thing.
So I know, Dad, for 66 years after that nightmare that you experienced, you never talked about it.
No.
You didn't share it with Mom. You didn't, do anything because, as you've explained to us, you were afraid people would think you were crazy, and nobody was talking about PTSD then, right?
That's right.
So why did you finally get help? Why are you here today, and why have you written this book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War?
Well, I went 66 years, and after that, Normandy, by the way, and I just can't go into all of it, but I was in Okinawa invasion also, mm-hmm. and that was, we lost 14,000 men, you know, and 62,000 wounded. So this was one of the things, a 17-year-old seeing all of these horrible things stayed in your head, and I kept getting flashbacks, and then I thought they would put me in a mental institution if I told anyone. So if anyone asked me, were you in the service? I said, I was in the Navy. And if they asked me anything, I said, I don't want to talk about it. And that was it.
But you did finally get help through the VA, right?
Thank God.
I finally went
after 66 years. I went through 3.5 years of treatment. And the guy got me through. Some of it was pretty horrible because I didn't want to go back after the first session. But then I was able to talk about it. Then I was able to write about it. And then eventually when I got healed, I wrote this book.
Okay.
Well, listen, we'll be right back. We've got a few more questions we'd like to ask you, Jack. And I know our listeners would love to hear the recovery side of what happened on the PTSD.
Yeah, great idea.
So we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
We'll be back with Transition Radio and your hosts, Paula Shaw and Kendi Foster. Would you like to help someone in need to move from poverty to prosperity? Stars of Courage, a 501c3 nonprofit, is looking for established life coaches with experience in education and career mentorship to build confidence and create clear paths to success. Join our team of experienced coaches in a wide variety of fields, equipped with warm hearts with a passion for lifting up those in need. Our Stars of Courage. Find out how you can make a difference at starsofcourage.org. That's starsofcourage.org. We're back with Transition Radio, exploring the world of change. And now, here's your hosts, Paula Shaw and Ken D. Foster.
Welcome back to Transition Radio. And today we have Mr. Jack Gutman on the show. Jack's written a book called One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War. And Jack, we were just talking about that PTSD and you know, how you kept that a secret for many years, and then how you decided, what made you decide to get the healing that you wanted, you did?
And for any of our listeners who just joined, we're talking about D-Day, the invasion of Normandy, and Dad was there.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I finally got to write the book was because I was sabotaging my marriage, my life. I was doing stupid, crazy things. I used comedy to cover it over, and I was going 66 years and started doing some heavy drinking. And so therefore, when I finally went to the veterans and they said to me, what's wrong? I told them, and they set me up with a psychiatrist and then a therapist. And I went through the first session with him, and he took me back to Normandy. And it was so horrible that he said, we're going to melt those things down. And then I said, I'm not going to come back anymore. Then finally I decided I better do it. So 3.5 years I went through. Then finally when I got cured, I decided to write this book. And I didn't want to hold anything back because I wanted to express to people what I went through and how people are killing themselves every day, veterans, when they don't need to. Mm-hmm. They need help. And I just plead with you, please get help. Changed my whole life. I've got a whole new marriage and everything else because of the veterans' help. And I wrote that in my book. It's on Amazon.com. It only sells less than $10.
And the title is One Veteran's Journey
to Heal the Wounds of War.
Yeah.
And got a picture of me when I was 21.
You look like a stud, dude.
You look just like good. You do now, except with dark hair.
Anyway, and I held nothing back in my book because I want you to learn that you can go through problems, and it's not for my glory, it's to help you, because if I got through it, you can do it too. So definitely get help.
Thank you so much, Dad. And thank you for sharing that story today. We have with us in studio today, Ken, two incredibly admirable men. Tell us a little bit about Azeem.
I sure will. And I also want to thank you, Jack, for being here, because that was really amazing. That was a great story. It painted the word picture of Normandy and launching the attack there that you were part of. So, I'd never heard it described that way. If you're just tuning in, you might want to listen to our Facebook rebroadcast and go to Transition Radio and listen to what Jack just said. Mm-hmm. So right now we have a friend of mine and a gentleman that has done some, I consider, extraordinary things in his life. His name is Azeem Kamisa. Azeem is the chairman, CEO, and founder of the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, and he's been a author, he's an activist, inspirational speaker. He was born in Kenya, Africa, and he's focused his training in mathematics, economics, international finance, and eventually becoming an international investment banker and pursuing that trade for over 35 years. Mr. Kamisa became a social activist after his 20-year-old son, Tariq, was murdered while he was delivering pizza in January 1995 by Tony Hicks, a 14-year-old gang member and son, a grandson of Plus Felix. So Mr. Kamisa believed that there were victims at both ends of the gun. And he's here to tell us about that story and how we can all look at the tragic events in our life and move on. Mm-hmm. If anybody can move on, you have. You're such an inspiration to me.
Incredible inspiration.
Yeah. So Azeem, welcome.
Thank you, Ken.
Yes, welcome.
Paula. Thanks for having me on your show.
Please tell us a little bit. You know, I've been working with grieving people for 26 years, and I know that most of us think there's nothing that could be more painful or more horrifying than the death of our children, because it's unnatural in the way we expect life to flow, right? And yet you had this happen in a senseless way. Can you share your story with our listeners?
Yeah, losing a child probably is a nightmare of most parents. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated, it's very complex. and very devastating. And it was that way for me, too. He was a good kid. He was a student at San Diego State University, wanted to become a journalist, and a great writer and a great photographer and a joy to be around and a great sense of humor. And he worked Fridays and Saturdays as a pizza delivery man just to make some extra money for college. And this was the last delivery on January 21st of 1995, as Ken mentioned. It was his turn. So, you know, he was lured to a bogus address in North Park, San Diego, by a youth gang. There was four of them. Three of them were 14-year-olds, and the leader was an 18-year-old. And my son knocked on many doors trying to find out who'd ordered the pizzas, because nobody had. He came back to his car, put the pizzas in the trunk, and as he was about to leave the scene of the crime, the 18-year-old gave a 9mm handgun to a 14-year-old and commanded him to shoot him. Gang initiation, because he fired one round, but it was fatal. And Tariq drowned in his own blood a couple of minutes later over a lousy pizza at the age of 20.
So I assume these gang members fled the scene. How did you find out what happened?
Yeah, the leader, just after the 14-year shot him, the leader said, run, 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 don't drop the gun. And they went back to the house where everybody was waiting for the pizzas, because there was no pizzas. And there was a girl that was part of the gang that actually had a mature voice, because most of these kids were 14, 15, 16, that ordered the pizza. And she was devastated to know what had happened and eventually called. I have a friend who has another nonprofit organization that I was on the board. And he was, because I was totally devastated, you know, that there was no way I was able to even function immediately after that. So he went on air and saying, if anybody knows anything about who's responsible for this death, because it's a son of one of our board members. And then she called him. And then he met her and then eventually convinced her to talk to the police. And of course, she had to be in the witness protection program and had to leave San Diego and move to Kansas City. But back 10 years later, I actually have met her too.
Azeem, you say that there was victims on both ends of the gun. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, I think that was the reason I wrote my first book. I've written four, because I get asked that question a lot, Ken. But sometimes
the first book is Murder to Forgiveness, A Father's Journey. And you wrote that right after this incident.
98, 3 years after it. Yeah. But I think sometimes in deep trauma, there is a spark of clarity. When you look at it, every saint has had the dark night of the soul. And I grew up in the Sufi tradition, and my mom was very spiritual, my dad was a businessman, so I grew up with equal emphasis on my spiritual life and my career. And I started to meditate when I was 20, and I lost Tariq in my early 40s. So I had a pretty good spiritual background. I used to do an hour a day. Today my practice is 2 hours a day, and there is a free download on meditation on my website.
And what is your website?
AzeemKhamisa.com is my name.
Let me just spell that out for our listeners real quick. So it's Azeem, A-Z-I-M, Khamisa, K-H-A-M-I-S-A.com.
Right. So if anybody's interested in meditation, I actually do teach it now, because now I do 2 hours. So when I got the call from the police to tell me that Tariq had been shot and killed, my knee-jerk reaction was I made a mistake, because you can't go there as a parent.
Of course.
I thought, you know, they must have made a mistake. It didn't make any sense. So I very quickly called his home. He had just gotten engaged to Jennifer, which was his fiancée, and they'd moved together in an apartment in North Park, fully expecting him to pick up the phone.
Of course.
Of course he didn't. She did, and she couldn't really say anything.
Did she know by then?
She knew, because the police went to her house first.
Oh, I see.
And that's when it hit. I was in my kitchen. I remember losing strength in both of my legs as I collapsed to the floor. Hit my head against the refrigerator and curled up into a ball. The pain was so excruciating. I don't have the words for it, but it was kind of like what Jack talked about. It was like a nuclear bomb that went off in my heart. And I remember that the pain was so so tough. It was, so painful that I couldn't even be in my body. And I had my first out-of-body experience. I believe in God. As I said, I practice as a Sufi Muslim. And I left my body and I went into the loving arms of God. And I was gone for a long time. I don't remember how long. And God held me in an embrace. And when the explosion subsided, He sent me back into my body with that wisdom that there are victims at both ends of the gun. Mm-hmm. So it didn't come from my intellect. It didn't come from my loving heart. It was a gift that came from a higher power. Because an hour and a half after, I lived by myself. My best friend was with me, and his wife went to get Jennifer, Tariq's fiancée, because she was by herself. Yeah. And my best friend said to me, but by this time we knew there were some eyewitnesses and there was a youth gang involved. And his sentiment was that whoever these kids are that killed Tariq, I hope they fry in hell. And my response to him was, I don't feel that way. An hour and a half after, wow. I said there are victims at both ends of the gun. And I remember they have a son called Adam, and he cried. He says, Azim, where do you get this strength? Because somebody took my son's life. Not only would I want the killer, I would want the whole clan. So that kind of started my journey.
Right.
And 9 months later, I decided to start the Tariq Khamisa Foundation. With a mindset that the enemy isn't the 14-year-old, but the societal forces that force many young men to fall to the crack. Reached out to his grandfather, and last October, we celebrated the 21st anniversary of the Tariq Khamisa Foundation. And we're successfully keeping kids away from gangs and drugs and alcohol and crime and weapons.
We want to hear so much more about that. We need to take a quick break, but let's come back and talk about the Tariq Foundation.
We'll be back with Transition Radio and your hosts, Paula Shaw and Kendi Foster.
Baby boomers, are you prepared? In a recent study from Transamerica, 45% of baby boomers are expecting a financial decrease in their standard of living after retirement. If you live into your 90s, you can go without a paycheck for 30 years. Hi, I'm Steve Sexton from Sexton Advisor Group. With almost 20 years in the business, I can answer your retirement questions. Get your complimentary retirement guide by calling 1-800-560-2611. That's 1-800-560-2611. Or go to SextonAdvisorGroup.com. That's S-E-X-T-O-N advisorgroup.com.
Is living in today's fast-paced world making you feel stressed and out of balance? Are anxiety, sleeplessness, depression, lack of focus, or weight gain robbing you of your relationship and your energy? If you're ready for change, you need to call Paula Shaw at Rebalancing You. Paula helps you identify and eliminate self-sabotaging thinking and behavior. Using a wide variety of mind-body techniques, she provides her clients with the most effective processes for their specific needs. To book a rebalancing session with Paula, call 858-480-9234. That's 858-480-9234.
We're back with Transition Radio, exploring the world of change. And now, here's your hosts, Paula Shaw and Ken D. Foster.
And welcome back to Transition Radio. We're having an amazing day today here on D-Day. My dad, Jack Gutman, has shared his story of landing on Omaha and Utah Beach and the invasion of Normandy. And in our last segment, we were talking with Azim Khamisa, who has an amazing story of the position he took after his son was murdered senselessly by a gang member. And Azim, I want to quote something you said here to bring this segment back because I thought it was so beautiful. You said, "We humans continuously confront defining moments in our lives. Sometimes these events are joyous, sometimes they're tragedies. At these moments, it's important to make the right choices. When we do, we are literally able to manifest a miracle and produce transformation in ourselves and others." You made the choice to forgive and to create the Tariq Khamisa Foundation rather than live the rest of your life in bitterness and anger about the loss of your son. So So tell us more about that foundation it's done in your life.
It was the right choice for me. Of course, it was 22 years ago. And of course, at that point, I did not really know everything that has manifested in my life as a result of that choice. Because my first book, as Karen mentioned, was From Murder to Forgiveness. And then from there, I went to Forgiveness to Fulfillment, because the work that I've done in my son's foundation has been very fulfilling. I've given over 1,000 presentations worldwide to students, teaching nonviolence, empathy, compassion, and forgiveness. I have over 100,000 letters from students. This has been it's been very fulfilling.
To Fulfillment was your second book, correct?
And then I followed it with Fulfillment to Peace. So it was a 22-year journey that started with murder, which is very, very dark.
Of course.
But ended up in peace. And the portal was forgiveness. But it started with this perspective that there were victims at both ends of the gun. And I really did not know how big the problem was, but youth violence is a huge issue.
Let's talk about that a little bit. How big is
it? I mean, we lose between 14 and 16 kids every day Every day. And if that was not a travesty, another 200 plus kids are arrested for violent crime where there is a weapon involved. Every single day. I'm talking kids.
And we're talking
ages 12 to 18. Yeah.
Just in America.
Just in the United States. Cool. I mean, the Economist did a study. They took 25 countries, first world countries like Canada and Australia and England, Germany, France, and added all the kids that die in those 25 countries as a result of gun violence. They took that total and multiplied that by 11. That is how many we lose in the United States of America. So when it comes to violence, we are a terrible role model.
Azeem, let me ask you something about that. I know it's a complicated subject, why people turn to violence. But in your opinion, studying this for the last 21 years, why is this happening and what are the solutions for this that your foundation,
right,
I know, is providing?
A lot of it is generationals. So the idea is that I have now met many gang members. And I've met gang members that are third or fourth generation of gang members. So they essentially were born in that tradition. Or they join gangs because they don't have belonging in their own homes. Because it's a lot of the gang members are like Tony, the kid who killed my son, was born to a 15-year-old. So there are issues of teen pregnancy.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, drugs and alcohol play a big part in it. So what we've decided to do is to work in the middle years. So the Tariq Hamisa Foundation specializes in teaching the principles of nonviolence between fifth and ninth grade, because that's really where the issues are. I mean, the middle schools in our country don't have the same resources as elementary and high school do. So we're very, very focused. The kid who killed my son joined a gang in sixth grade when he was 11 years old and took my son's life when he was in eighth grade. So what we are showing through our story, because we are introduced, we have created what we call a safe school model, and it has several programs. The first program is a live assembly with the grandfather and I. So we are introduced, this man's grandson killed this man's son, and here they are together in the spirit of brotherhood, forgiveness, and compassion. The grandfather is African-American, my roots are Eastern, he's Christian, I am Muslim. His kid killed my son, and we've been together for 21 years.
Working together.
Working, and we'll continue to work together. We're going to New York next week till we're no longer able to. So it's a very much a visual when they see it.
Powerful.
So, yeah, and then he shares a story about Tony, the kid who killed my son. And what we're teaching through our story is the principles of empathy, of compassion, of forgiveness, and more importantly, of peacemaking. And then we have an in-classroom curriculum, which is a 10-week curriculum based on restorative practices. The kid who killed my son is now 36, and he wrote the foreword to my last book, which was From Fulfillment to Peace, and did a great job. And he comes out. I've been trying to get him out for 12 years now. He comes out of October of 2018.
Wait, would you say that again for our listeners? You've been trying to get him out for 12 years?
Yes, because I know he's changed as a result of my forgiveness. He's 12 units away from his degree in child psychology.
Oh, my God.
He reads 5 books a month. He can talk to you intelligently on a lot of the literature. He writes poetry himself. And I can't wait to have him on stage with his grandfather and me, because I know that we've saved him. But when he gets on stage and says, when I was 11, I joined a gang. When I was 14, I killed Mr. Kamis Hassan. I've spent the last umpteen years in prison. I'm here to tell you it's not worth it. Kids will listen to that voice because his intonations will be of a person who pulled the trigger that wants to turn the clock back.
And this is what he wants to do when he comes out to work with you and his grandfather.
Yeah, so it's a redemption, it's a restoration. And I could have, you know, gone the other way. What good would that have done?
Exactly.
But trying to get Tony to turn around, and he'll be a very powerful emissary of what others may not follow in his former footsteps, because I know he would like to turn the clock back. So the point that I was trying to make here is that when I looked at all these problems we have in our society, I felt that we were not doing enough to make sure that kids don't fall through the cracks. So I started the foundation 9 months after he died with a mission to essentially stop kids from killing kids by breaking the cycle of youth violence. And we essentially have three mandates. First mandate is to save lives of children, because we lose a lot every single day. It's important to do. Mm-hmm. Our second mandate is to empower the right choices so they don't fall through the crack and pick lives of crime and drugs and alcohol and weapons. And our third mandate is to teach the principles of nonviolence. Because I started with a very simple premise that violence is a learned behavior.
Right.
No child was born violent, including the kid who killed my son. Mm-hmm. But if you accept that as an axiom or a truism, then nonviolence can also be a learned behavior. Where do our kids learn nonviolence? Mm. So we teach, you know, we have classes on empathy, on compassion, on forgiveness, on peacemaking, on resolutions of how you make good decisions. And we've had many, many, you know, I just did a talk at San Diego State University, and this kid came up to me and he said, you know what, you really changed my life because you came to my school when I was in sixth grade, and you're a banker. And I just graduated in a degree in finance. And I would not have done that because my older brother was in a gang, my father was in a gang, my grandfather was in a gang. He was fourth generation gang member. So this interference is, we're seeing many, many examples that these principles are not only teachable, our kids are hungry for that.
Yes.
And that gives me some hope.
Oh, me too. That's how beautiful. Good. What a beautiful.
You know, I when you're saying there's fourth generation gang members, that's new information to me. I'm just listening to that and hearing that and going, oh my goodness. It's insidious in the society.
You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was just thinking, do you feel that the violent video games and things that kids today are playing, are they contributing to this problem?
Yes, I think a lot in our society is contributing to violence. It's not video games. Mm-hmm. You'll be shocked to hear by the time our kids get to grade one, so they are 6 years old, they've seen over 100,000 images of violence.
Oh my God.
Look at movies, look at television. You mentioned video games. The very much conditioning is we are very much an eye for an eye society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very rare. I mean, I actually go into inner city schools, and if you are in San Diego, you know, you're welcome to come witness us working with the kids.
Oh, I love that.
It's quite transformative. And I actually asked them, how many of you have lost family members as a result of violence? 2/3 of the hands go up.
Yes.
Now, this is, you know, working in middle school.
Oh.
This kid should not be dealing with that much grief. And then I ask him, how many of you would want revenge? Because all the hands go up, because that's society we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask him, would revenge make things better or worse?
Mm-hmm.
Make worse. Would it bring Tariq back?
Powerful.
No. Would it stop the grief? No. So one of the things that has, and we always, I came from a business background, as you did in my intro, so we measure everything. So we've had, you know, SDSU, USD, all of our universities that have done evaluations. And one thing that has been very reassuring is that we are able to actually teach kids how to forgive.
Wow.
And that's definitely what breaks the cycle. Revenge, yeah. You take one of mine, I take one of yours, pretty soon nobody's standing. But forgiveness actually breaks that cycle.
It's so powerful. When I was doing the research on you, I have to tell you, my son walked in the room because I was sobbing. It's so powerful and beautiful what you've created. and you so could have gone the other direction. So you are not just doing something wonderful, you're a model for a beautiful way to handle tragedy. And thank you so much for what you've shared today. I know we want to have him back, don't we, Ken?
I would love to have you back, Azeem. In fact, you know, we have a show coming up in July, July 4th, Freedom Day, right? Would you come back on that show?
Absolutely.
Tell a little bit more of your story on that show?
I would be very happy.
That's awesome.
That would be so wonderful.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Our next segment will be coming up, and we're calling it Smart Money. And Steve Sexton of Sexton Advisory Group is here to talk to us about smart money. Thanks again, Dad and Azeem Kamisa. And both of you have books that are available on Amazon, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yes, inspiring books that I'm sure our listeners would do well to get a hold of. All right, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we'll be right back.
We'll be back with Transition Radio and your hosts, Paula Shaw and Kendi Foster.
There's a question many of us ask ourselves when we are grieving. When will this pain ever end? Life transition coach and grief recovery specialist Paula Shaw wants you to know there is light at the end of the tunnel. In her new best-selling book, Paula gives you information and practical exercises you can use right away in your recovery process, including breathing methods, the emotional freedom technique, energy psychology work, and many other healing tools. Grief, when will this pain ever end? Available now on Amazon.com.
We're back with Transition Radio, exploring the world of change. And now, here's your hosts, Paula Shaw and Ken D. Foster.
And welcome back to Transition Radio, brought to you by the Sexton Advisory Group. And here in studio with us today is the fabulous and famous Steve Sexton.
Better check my makeup after that.
Who we love. Ken and I both worked with Steve on his own shows, the Silver-Haired Tsunami TV show and radio show. And he is the man at the Sexton Advisory Group, which we love because Steve's whole goal is serving clients in a kind of a holistic way. You know, he asks the questions that really help them to think about the whole picture. And he helps them to not only save money through a variety of ways that I'll let him tell you, but he really cares. That's one thing I do know about you, Steve. You care. And I think everybody who comes to you feels that too. So we're so excited to have you here today to talk to us about some smart money moves.
Well, thank you.
That's it. Steve, I've known you for quite a while now, and I love what you said about the you care piece, because that really is what comes across. There's a part of him that's very sincere that really wants the best for everybody to succeed. So, Steve, how did you get involved with finances, Sexton Advisory? What motivated you to start this up and get things going?
Well, I first of all, you know what? Got to the point where I didn't want to work for a big company anymore.
So I think a few people can relate to that.
got tired of implementing other people's decisions that I didn't think were right, so I went on my own. And I started out with the you know, helping out with people with health insurance, and people kept coming to me and saying, you know what, I have issues with my retirement, my long-term care, and those type of things. And I expanded more and more into the field. What really kicked me off was in 2007 when I went through cancer. I had, you know, about a colon cancer. Mm. And one of the biggest things that I found out is when I was in the hospital, I have a habit of, you know, walking the halls because they told me that could heal me faster. And, you know,
so how fast did you walk those halls?
it was more like 30 or 40 times when I really wasn't supposed to go that many times, but they got a kick out of it. But I ended up meeting people and talking with people and telling people what I did. And they said, you know what, I'm really afraid. You know what, my husband has got, you know, terminal cancer. And I'd say, do you have a trust? And they're like, well, I don't. Wow, you know, you can have a lot of money and things create problems for you if you don't have it. And people there were saying, you know, I wish I had prepared my wife for this. this moment here, especially when I was going through chemo. So I knew there was much more that I needed to do, that I wanted to do so I can serve people. And one of the things I found out in my research is there's so much money just falling through the cracks in people's financial plans. So just real quickly, yesterday, I'm helping out the Lymphoma Leukemia Society. And this gentleman comes to me, he's giving $10,000 out of his checking account every single year to charity. Okay, he's 72 years old. And I said, you know, if you're giving that much to charity every single year, why don't you do it in a different way? Because I showed him that he was basically saving $100 in taxes by giving that $10,000 out of his checking account. But if he gave it from his IRA and gave it directly to the charity, he'd actually save his taxes by about $3,700.
Wow.
So it was just, how do you take the distribution? And we did just little things like that. Make sure his money isn't falling through the cracks. And that's the thing that's important when you're in retirement.
That can make such a huge difference. And I know I find myself thinking, I would never have known that, you know? And I mean, that's why I'm so glad I know you, Steve, because I know you're looking at taxes, you're looking at insurance, you're looking at all sorts of aspects of people's financial plan, right? So that if adversity strikes or something, or a health crisis like we're discussing, people are not going to be stripped of everything they have.
Well, this is the part with the retirement strategy, the planning that goes along with it. See, you know what the reality is? We talk about financial crisis, the market going down. Okay, that happens on average every 5.5 years since 1929.
Wow.
So that means it's going to happen. So you might as well plan for it. So you put rules in place in your own financial investing to make sure if the market's going to go down by 20 or 30%, that you don't go down by 20 or 30%. It's not timing the market. It's just, hey, you put those rules in place. If it's a health crisis, how do you plan for it? Whether it be long-term care, moving into a continued care retirement community, whether like my folks who want to live in one of the continued care retirement communities because their kids, they don't want their kids, they want their kids to have a retirement. So what is it? Plan for it now. So when it happens, you already know what to do, not running around with your head cut off. So when I went through cancer, one of the things we realized and was taught to us by a healthcare person, she says more people spend time picking out the color of a car or where they're going to travel to than how to plan for this portion of retirement.
Wow. That's shocking.
You know, you said if we go through adversity, I think we all go through adversity. And, you know, there's a part that I think there, a lot of people are in denial of that it is there. It is coming. And unless you prepare properly, you're going to reap the devastation of what adversity can bring to all of us.
That
right?
That is so true. Because when you look at trust, 50% of people who pass away don't have a trust. That means their assets go into probate. So you know what probate is? It's a lawsuit filed by yourself against yourself, and you lose. And by the way, you fund it through your estate as well. And what a lot of people don't realize is the state of California takes over. If you love the way the state of California is handling their affairs, they can now handle your money if you pass away without a trust.
Wow.
You're like, I'm sorry, that was scary.
That's really
okay,
scary.
Okay,
but
you know,
really
honestly, we're, you know, this is D-Day today, and we've had some amazing guests here, and you're another one. And we've been talking about, you know, what happens on, you know, through the adversity and what happens on the other side of it. So what is it that you can do to help people to acknowledge that they are there? There's challenges here. And you, people come to you all the time. That must be a difficult thing because people like to live in denial sometimes. How do you break that?
It's by asking the question, you know, what's, you know, Paula, Ken, what are you going to do if, you know, healthcare comes into your life or the need for care at the house comes into your life? How are you going to handle that? How are you going to finance it? And then I shut up and let them answer the questions. And sometimes it's very uncomfortable because they haven't talked about that because they don't want to deal with that because they don't want to see somebody that they loved in a position of pain. I mean, it's really tough. My wife watched me go through cancer and chemotherapy, and all she can do is love me, but really couldn't help. And that was a tough position to be in. And you deal with, Polly, you deal with people all the time. It's the same way when they're looking at their finances. I mean, the reality is my dad didn't think he was going to die until he had gallstones. Those are kind of painful.
Those are painful, right.
So at that point, he's like, oh, my God, Steve, we got to start teaching mom how to do this stuff if I'm not here. So
you're so right. You know, this factor of us not wanting to face the possibility of anything painful, tragic, or horrible, horrible happening in our lives is huge with human beings. You know, once it happens, like we've been talking about earlier on the show with Azeem and with Dad, then you have no choice. You have to deal with what's in front of you, a lot like you did, Steve, when the cancer struck. But do you do anything to, do you present workshops or any way that you're trying to educate people to try and open up awareness before they're in the middle of the crisis?
Yes, we do. Actually, we have a workshop called Tax and Retirement that's coming up next week on the 14th at the Penasquitas Library. It's free. There's nothing being sold. It's just all about taxes in retirement and understanding how that affects you.
Oh, that's
great. And the reality with, if you just take a little quibbit from taxes, by the way you take your distributions can determine how long your assets are going to last. And that means, how do I have those assets taxed? So it makes a big difference if you really look at those sequences. It isn't just, hey, I'm going to take it from my IRA and here and here and here, I'm going to get my pension. Mm-hmm. If you really take a look at it, it could make a difference on how long your assets last, especially when people are living longer nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. So, Steve, do you deal with everybody or are there specific clients that you seem to excel with?
Well, you know what? We work with people that are at or near retirement. So most of the time it's between 55 and our oldest client's 104. But most of the time we take on clients between the ages of 55 and 75. We do have a number of clients who work in the technology field, venture capital field that are in their 30s and 40s, but they're specific for that. Mm-hmm. They usually get large amounts of bonuses and big salaries, and they've never had them before.
And let me ask you this. You know, we have a lot of listeners out of state, and I'm wondering, how do people that are out of state, can they deal with you here locally?
Yes, they can deal with me locally. You know what? We have a 1-800 number of people call in. A lot of times we work with people on Skype. California isn't the best state for everybody, so we have about 25% of our clients actually live in another state now because they like the tax situation there or overseas. In which case, we have a lot of Skype conversations.
How do people reach you?
Just call our office. It's 1-800-560-2611. Again, that's 1-800-560-2611.
And could you repeat again, Steve, where that free workshop's going to be about? And you said it's about tax in retirement.
It's all about taxes in retirement. We go in from the basic to a little bit of complicated. It'll be for about an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. It's at the Penasquitas Library. Okay, and that's in Rancho Penasquitas.
Here in San Diego.
Yep, on June 14th. It starts at 6:30.
Okay.
You want to call 1-800-560-2611 and just ask for Brittany. She'll get you signed up for the workshop.
Fabulous. Would you give that phone number one more time?
Sure. It's 1-800-560-2611.
And what is your website, Steve? If people want to check you out and maybe join the Sexton Advisory Group and family.
It's sextonadvisorygroup.com. That's S-E-X-T-O-N advisorygroup.com.
Beautiful.
That's
if
great.
If you want somebody who really cares, this is your man.
Well, that show went by quick. Can you believe this?
Oh, it really did. We need another hour.
We do need another hour with all our guests. Well, listen, coming up next week, we have Mark Waldman. And he is a neuroscience researcher and creator of NeuroWisdom 101. He's a national best-selling author on how God changes your brain. And he was chosen to be on Oprah's must-read books in 2012. He's a leading expert on spirituality, communication, and the brain.
Oh, I can't wait.
Will that be amazing?
Yeah, it's going to be very amazing.
We also have Davi, and Davi is a man here locally in San Diego who is teaching people how to connect with one another and how to public speak in ways that nobody is doing. Mm. He's going to tell us the secrets to connecting deeply with the audience with the scariest thing in the world, public speaking. So he'll be here too, also.
Love that. And, of course, the fabulous Steve Sexton will be back to do a Smart Money segment with us, and we look so forward to that. And again, our other two guests today, Jack Gutman, my dad, has a book on Amazon called One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War. And Azeem Kamisa has several books on
Amazon. Yeah, he's got three books out there. The first one is From Murder to Forgiveness, A Father's Journey. He also has From Forgiveness to Fulfillment. And he has The Secrets of a Bulletproof Proof Spirit, which I can hardly wait to read, how to bounce back from life's hardest hits. And all of those you can find on Amazon. I know he's got another one out there too, and I'm
a new one coming up. Yes. Well, and Azeem will be joining us again, so
July 4th
of July. I look forward to another show. All right, thank you, Ken. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Paula.
All of our guests. We've had a wonderful evening. Good evening.